underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester Center, Vermont, and Saratoga Springs, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in Public Health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. This year marks the 30th anniversary of one of crime fiction's greatest characters, John Rebus. Created by one of the world's leading crime writers, Ian Rankin. Rebus's anniversary coincides with the release of Rather Be the Devil, Rankin's 21st Rebus novel. In the latest, Inspector Rebus is officially retired, but he can't forget an unsolved case from long ago as he starts re-examining the facts behind the murder of a woman at a luxurious hotel. Another murder occurs. He reunites with his old friends as they attempt to investigate the beating of a young gangster. Ian Rankin joins us on this week's Book Show to discuss the new novel and one of literature's greatest curmudgeons. Ian Rankin, thank you so much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you.
Thank you, Joe.
Can you believe 30 years? Can you contextualize that to make sense?
Well,
to you?
As you can see from my stunning young good looks, I was very young when I started writing these books. I was a student when I wrote the first one, and it was meant to be just a one-off. It was never meant to be the beginning of a series. And I was an accidental crime writer. I didn't really read the genre until I started writing these books. But this guy just wormed his way into my head, my consciousness, and he refused to leave. And added to that, I decided very early on that a police detective, is a very good way of looking at the world. If you want to look at social issues, problems, if you want to explore a city or a culture, a cop allows you to do that because he's got an all-access pass from the highest in the land to the lowest in the land. So very quickly, I realized I was onto a good thing. It took a while for readers to realize that, mind. First few books didn't sell in any numbers whatsoever. But I was just determined to stick with this guy, and he was determined to stick with me, so thank him very much.
When I went back, I probably maybe 10, 12 books in when I started in on the series, and then went back to read the early novels in the first novel. But you certainly see, I mean, all of the seeds were there. We very much had that character, didn't we?
Yeah, I mean, almost too many seeds were there. Because the first book was meant to be the only book, there's a lot of backstory. Now, if I'd known I was going to do a series, I would probably have just eked it out a little bit at a time, or I wouldn't have made it quite as convoluted. So there's certain things I've always got to remember about Rebus. He's afraid of flying. Why is he afraid of flying? Because of his army training.
Right.
Though I can't undo that. I can't unpick that. So I've always got to bear that in mind. He's a certain age in book one. He had to be about 40 years old because something happened in his past that he's managed to block. So, you know, time had to have passed. And of course, deciding to set the books in real time meant eventually I hit retirement. And then once he's retired, you think, what can I do with him? There's only so much a retired cop can do. So that gives you new tensions and new challenges. And I think that's what's kept the series fresh for me, is that when I approach each new book, the characters have changed slightly from the book before. So Rebus can no longer use his physical presence to intimidate suspects. And the fact that he doesn't carry a badge means that he can't use that to intimidate suspects. So he's got to find different ways of working.
When did you make that decision that A, it would be a series, and B, that you would keep it in real time and age this character from novel to novel?
My editor. I haven't written one Rebus novel. I then wrote a John le Carré-style homage spy novel, and then I wrote a techno thriller. I was trying to write anything that would make me a buck. You know, I was just trying to make enough money to live on, trying out all these different genres. But then my editor said, whatever happened to that guy Rebus, I liked him as a character. And I thought, okay, well, maybe I'll bring him back because there's more that I can do with him. There's more, I would like to spend more time with him. And I decided that I wanted to use the series as a way of talking about Scotland and Edinburgh and changes that were taking place. And I thought, well, how can you do that if your character is preserved in aspic, if your character doesn't change over time? So I thought, okay, he's going to age. I mean, I didn't realize he'd be around for as many, but 21 books, you know, 30 years. I didn't know that was going to happen. But I thought, well, it's interesting if he's changing, if he's aging. And so those decisions were made pretty early on in the series. And of course, I kind of slightly regret that I didn't make him younger in book one.
While you stick to that, there's also, I would assume, the control that any writer has. Just, well, I can do what I want. They can age quickly. They can be on the decline. You can certainly massage that a little bit.
Yeah, I have slowed the clock. The last two or three books, I've slowed the clock. I mean, in real time, Rebus would now be 70. You know, because he's 40 in book one. So 30 years in, he must be 70. So I've slowed the clock down quite a lot. So he's now still in his mid-60s. So I've still, you know, because I just thought eventually you're going to get to a stage where he's investigating crimes in an old people's home. You know, that's all I can, once he hits 70, 75, what am I going to do with him? But crime readers are very forgiving creatures. You know, nobody minds that P.D. James's detective Adam Dalgleish is 102 by the time of the later books, you know. And my publisher said that. I said, look, Rebus has to retire because he has hit the mandatory retirement age. And he said, just stop the clock. Readers won't notice. But I sort of felt I would be cheating by that stage. I thought, no, I've built him up as this character who does age. It would be cheating if suddenly he doesn't age anymore, but the world around him changes.
Ian Rankin is our guest. The new novel is Rather Be the Devil. So in this novel, as you say, the process has been slowed down a little, but he is on the outside and itching to get back in, which I think anyone, but especially someone who has been in this line of work, you know, once you're out, it's very, very hard.
Yeah, I mean, it can be hard. I mean, I do know cops who've made the transition. They take retirement on the chin and they find another source of revenue. They find something else they're interested in. They have hobbies, but Rebus has no hobbies. Detective work has been his life. And as long as he's investigating other people's lives, he doesn't have to think too much about his own life and the various, you know, mistakes he has made along the way. He doesn't have to think too much about himself. So without police work, he would be sitting in a bar, getting more and more morose and drinking himself to death. So he needs work. And I decided that, you know, all the cases he's worked on that never got a satisfactory conclusion, he has kept them. He's kept copies of the paperwork in a spare bedroom in his apartment. So I can dig into those, and that's what happens in this book, is that something triggers a memory in his head of a case he worked on tangentially that was never satisfactorily concluded. And that strikes with a lot of cops I know, a lot of detectives I know. They, you know, some of them have gone to their graves frustrated because there was one big case they couldn't break. And in fact, there was one recently in the UK and in Edinburgh, and I do reference it at the start of this book. Rebus was taken off the murder case that's in this book and put onto the World's End murders. And they were only solved a couple of years ago because of changes in DNA technology. That was a murder that happened in 1977. Two young teenage girls were found killed, and they only got the guy almost 40 years later because they'd kept all the evidence and DNA technology improved so that you could get a DNA fingerprint from some of the clothing. That struck home to me because I was talking to some of the cops who'd worked that case, and they said, we're so thrilled to get a result after all this time. Of course, they were all long retired, but they were so thrilled to get a result. And they said, we just feel sorry for our comrades who died before the result came in, going to their graves never knowing the truth.
There's that sense in this novel where, as you say, I mean, he is retired, but he also has health issues, and he's dealing with that too. Hello, welcome, getting older, right?
That's my wife. She's responsible for that. She's been saying to me for a few years now, she's been saying, look, this guy's had such a lucky health ride. He drinks like a fish. He smokes. He doesn't eat the right foods. He takes no exercise. Come on, he's in his 60s. There's got to be something. And she's got a very good friend. They play bridge together. And her good friend is a doctor, a GP, a general practice doctor. So I sat down with her and I said, look, what would you expect someone like Rebus to present if he walked into your surgery? And we went through half a dozen or a dozen possible problems for him to have. And she said, I'd be very, very, very surprised if this guy didn't have COPD, a pulmonary disorder. So I thought, well, is it life-threatening? She said, not necessarily life-threatening, but it's serious enough that it will focus his attention. And this book is really me saying to my wife, okay, look, this is you getting your way at last. There's some fun to be had with that. You know, he sits in the bar and he's trying not to drink and he's trying not to smoke, and there's somebody tapping on the window telling him, come outside, I've got a pack of cigarettes, you can have one of mine. And he's trying to be good. He's trying to be good, but it isn't always necessarily working.
When you are writing those scenes like that, does the humor come easily to you?
Oh, I think it's a very Scottish thing. I'll give you an example of that from my own life. Last year, I was quite a bit overweight, and I made the decision to lose weight, and I was very successful. And the first time I walked back into my local bar, they went, "Oh my God, Ian, have you got some health issues? Have you got a problem?" They didn't see it as a positive. They were always thinking on the negative side, you know. And even now, they still make a joke of it. How do you deal with adversity? If you're a certain kind of person, if you've got a certain philosophy of life, you joke about it, you make light of it. And a lot of the cops I've met over the course of my life, because of the kind of job they do, because of the nature of the job they do, how do they let off steam? They've got a very dark sense of humour, a very black sense of humour, which they can only share with other professionals. You cannot go home and be light and be jokey about some of these crimes that you're investigating, but you can do it to your fellow officers, and it's a way of dealing with it. It's a way of dealing with the kind of horrible nature of the stuff you're looking at day in and day out.
So you made that sound like a cop thing and a Scottish thing.
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, I think it's both. Yeah, I mean, Scots always look on the dark side of life. You know, we always look on the negatives, and we're always, you know, not always. We can be quite cheery and light-hearted. I mean, come Edinburgh in August when the festival's on, we're all kind of, hooray, we've got comedy shows and music and everything. But you go there in January, February, you know, we're all going, oh, we're doomed. We're doomed. It's winter. Long winters and short summers, which means we do read a lot of books, and we also seem to write a lot of books.
We should also note that some of the other characters here, but I do want to get into Morris Gerald Cafferty. This is certainly a battle of wills in this novel, but a character that came in at what point in the series?
Book three, I needed Rebus to go to Glasgow for some reason, and I thought, okay, what's he doing there? Oh, he's giving evidence in a trial. Who's he giving evidence against? And Glasgow at that time had a tradition of gangsters in a way that Edinburgh, being a smaller city, really didn't. It was too small to have a Mr. Big. So I thought, okay, Cafferty is this gangster, and Rebus is giving evidence against him. And then a couple of books later, I thought, whoa, what an interesting character he was. And it's almost as though every detective in fiction needs their Moriarty. And that's what he is. I mean, he's a guy who can represent all the bad stuff in the world. All the bad stuff that's happening, I can focus and funnel it to Cafferty and say he's behind it. But as with Rebus, he has been aging in real time, and he finds himself surrounded by younger, more venal villains who don't have a code of ethics or conduct in a way that he actually does. And Rebus and him have this empathy between them because they come from a similar background and they're similar age. And so there's an empathy there, if not a sympathy. And the previous book ended with Cafferty walking away from Rebus, holding up a finger to say, I've got one good fight left in me. Mm. So these are two old men, basically. Well, old men. In their 60s, it's not that old. But they're two men who possibly should have left the boxing ring by now. Like two old heavyweights who should have left the ring because younger, fitter heavyweights have come into the ring. And they're just looking around bewildered going, do we have any role to play in the world? Do we still make sense in the world? Can we still make a difference to the world? And this book is Cafferty's story. It's a story of that one last good fight.
You also get the sense of, I'll ask you, is the word respect, do you think, appropriate in their relationship?
In their relationship, possibly. I mean, I think they can't imagine a world without each other. They're fitting adversaries. And so, yeah, I mean, it's sort of respect that you possibly would get in a Sherlock Holmes Moriarty relationship or something like that, yeah.
Sure, they want to, perhaps there are times where they want to kill each other. However, they are, as you said, they can't imagine that world without one another.
Yeah, and when the Rebus series was going to end the first time, so Exit Music was book number 17, and I thought, this is it, Rebus has to retire now. It ended up with Cafferty pretty much on his deathbed in a hospital and Rebus trying to save him. And he's trying to save him because he cannot imagine a world without Cafferty. He needs someone like that to keep punching against, I guess, to keep sparring with. And then when I brought Rebus back, I thought, okay, I'm bringing Cafferty back as well. He's too good a character to miss. The problem with them is, I mean, I don't know if you find this as a reader, they suck all the energy from a scene. They suck all the oxygen from a room. So when Rebus is in a scene, people like Siobhan Clarke and Malcolm Fox, the professional detectives, almost disappear because he's such a larger-than-life figure. And Cafferty's the same. So you put Rebus and Cafferty in a scene, great, but you put Rebus or Cafferty in a scene, the other players just seem to disappear.
What is the challenge of that in the writing? I mean, obviously you're aware of it.
Yeah. Yeah, well, the challenge is to try and show that there are other people around and maybe show their reaction to this. I mean, are they kind of standing back because these players are such big people, such big personalities that you just want to watch them and study them and learn from them? Or you're hoping that they'll slip up? You're hoping they'll make a mistake because they're big, confident personalities and you're just watching and waiting. So someone like Malcolm Fox, who really is a professional voyeur, he's very much the quiet man who sort of... it just lingers on the periphery of things, watching, learning, studying, and then makes his move when everything is safe for him to do so. You know, there's a lot I can do with that relationship. And in this book, Rebus cannot tell Siobhan Clark, his one-time colleague, they've been very close professionally and personally. Mm. He can't tell her he's got an illness or a weakness, but he sees no problem with telling. He's got to tell someone. And he sees no problem with telling Malcolm Fox. And he tells Fox, the only reason I'm telling you this is you don't care enough about me for it to make a difference.
But of course she knows.
She works it out. She works it out, yeah. And then you've kind of got this, they're dancing around each other as he tries not to spell it out for her, but knowing that she knows. But they're never going to sort of confront one another. That's not the way they work, and it's not the way Scots often work. You want people to work things out without you having to tell them the stuff face to face.
How often do you deal with that? I mean, obviously these are international books, but do you feel a obligation at all to kind of explain Scottish culture when you are presenting these characters, or do you figure it, the reader will figure it out eventually?
A little bit of both, I suppose. I mean, you don't want to put in stuff that's going to confuse readers who don't have the context, but there's a lot of it you can get from the context. As specific problems in the States, there's a little bit of a conversation I sometimes have with my publisher about how many British terms or Scottish words we can use in the text without confusing readers. But readers love it. I mean, when American readers go to Edinburgh, they can go to the Oxford Bar where I drink and where Rebus drinks. They can go to the police station he works at. They can go to the apartment building where he lives. And they absolutely love it. And they love all the Scotticisms. They love the local cultural references. And they get it. I mean, readers are not stupid people. They can look stuff up. And these days, you can look things up very easily. And I get a lot of complaints I get are things like, for example, in the States, one book, the title was changed from Flesh Market Close to Flesh Market Alley. Now, a close is a Scots word for a kind of an alley. And when they come to Edinburgh, there is Flesh Market Close. It's a real street. And they go, how come you changed it? How come? Where's Flesh Market Alley? And they go, well, my publisher wasn't sure you would know what a close was, so they changed it.
The marketing forces at work.
Kind of, you know. I mean, I can understand why you would do it. But, you know, there's no way you can have Rebus use the word clabbered or trunk of a car. He just wouldn't do it in conversation because we don't have those terms. And if you can have him say the boot of a car without confusing the reader, then please do.
The wonderful thing that I was thinking of this about halfway through this novel is that how remarkably complex a character Rebus is. And even though, and I'm asking this as a question because I assume this is the case for you as the writer, even though I've read all of these novels and I know this character so well, he's still extremely complex, and there are sides to that personality that are still a surprise to us.
And to me. I mean, that's the reason I've kept writing these books, is the only way I can learn more about this character. The only way I can make sense of him is to continue to write about him. And even having written 21 books with him as a central character, there's still information he's holding back. There are still aspects of his personality, his past, his philosophy of life that I won't know until I write the next book. And there was one very concrete example of that. It was a book I was writing. Actually, it was Flesh Market Close, Flesh Market Alley, which was about migration and immigration policy and asylum seekers and people trafficking and all that sort of thing. And just before I started writing it, so I was mulling it over, I met a guy in Edinburgh who said his name was Joe Rebus. And I said, whoa, I didn't know it was a surname. It's a picture puzzle. If you look it up in the dictionary, a rebus is a kind of puzzle, which is why I came up with it. He said, oh no, it's a Polish surname. I went, okay, Rebus is Polish. I didn't know this. But it made sense. Partly it made sense because then there was an extra resonance in that book about people trafficking, but partly when I was at school, there were a lot of people with East European names at school with me because their parents had all come to the UK to escape the war in mainland Europe around about 1939-40. A lot of Poles worked for the RAF and the army in the UK against Germany. And I said, okay, so that makes sense that Rebus's family would have come here at some point in the early 20th century. And so he has Polish roots. And that meant that he had more of a connection to the story. And it was very pleasing to me. The one weird thing about that is, and you can check this, you can get a phone directory and check this, Edinburgh phone directory. The guy that I met, Rebus, Joe Rebus, Rebus J, J for Joe, if you look him up in the phone directory, his address is Rankin Drive. Rankin Drive.
Wow.
And that's no connection to me. There are three roads, three streets in Edinburgh with the name Rankin in them. And it's just a complete coincidence, if you believe in coincidence.
Yeah, that's pretty neat. You tried, you mentioned this in the course of our conversation, but you did try to retire this character and wrap everything up in exit music. What happened with that idea ultimately? And do you think, given that experience, that you will ever be able to do that?
Oh, gosh. Well, I mean, what happened was five years on from retiring Rebus, possibly 4 years on from retiring Rebus, I got an idea for a cold case. It was a novel involving a cold case, an unsolved case. And it was a real life group a case unit in Edinburgh that dealt with all the cold cases in that part of the world. And they were staffed entirely by retired detectives. I thought, okay, what do? Do I invent a new retired detective? Well, I've already got one. You know, I've got one. So this is going to be a Rebus book. And the first page of that book was about as nervous as I've ever been. Because not having thought much about him or written about him for over 4 years, I thought, is the voice still going to be there? Does he still want to come out and play? Or is he quite happy in my subconscious? And the first page, the blank sheet of paper was just absolutely nerve-wracking. And then when he did arrive, he arrived on the page as though I'd unlocked a cell and let him out. He was so pleased to be back there again. And so I was relieved. And then, yeah, then the challenge was I was able to bring him back as a police officer for a few years. And then thought, well, actually, you know, they shut down the cold case unit. They moved it elsewhere. And I thought, well, Rebus is gone again. He's properly retired this time, which gives me new challenges. But I'm enjoying those challenges. I'm enjoying trying to get him involved in cop work while he's not really a cop. And it's some fun to be had with that because he's no longer a cop. He doesn't have to obey any of the rules or any of the high ups, any of the bosses. He doesn't have to go by their rule book anymore. Can I imagine a world without him? Yeah. How would it work? I don't know. I mean, I don't have a plan. There's never been a plan. So I've got no idea what the next book will be. I get a theme I want to explore. I get a plot that allows me to explore that theme. Then I think, whose book is this? And it could be a Siobhan Clarke book. It could be another Fox book. It could be a Rebus book. It could be a book from Cafferty's point of view. I've no idea till I sit down and start to think about it.
In something you just said, and I apologize if I'm getting overly psychological here, there was something you just said about that idea of not thinking of the character for a while. And I've talked to many authors who have had series characters for a very, very long time. And they talk about this great friendship and that they are one with the character and they live together and it's hard for them to tell where they themselves, the writer, ends and the character begins. So it just seems in that one moment that you don't have that necessarily and maybe wouldn't even have the closest relationship with Rebus.
Well, I mean, he wouldn't like me if he met me. He just wouldn't. I mean, there's no way this guy would
who
like me.
He couldn't like you.
No, he could. He wouldn't. He'd see me as being a kind of wishy-washy liberal who's never had to do a hard day's work in his life. You know, suckled by the state from birth, free education, free healthcare, you know, wrote his first novel when he was a student, getting paid to do it, and became a writer. And he'd see me as a child who's never grown up, because all novelists are children who refuse to grow up. We're still playing with our imaginary friends, and we're still having these adventures that all kids do inside their heads, all these role-playing games that all kids play. And at some point, the adult world says, you've got to stop doing that. And writers go, no thanks, I like playing with my imaginary friends. It keeps me young, and it's therapeutic, and it's great. You get to play God. You've got the power of life and death over your characters in a way that isn't possible in the real world. And you can give a shape to the world. You can give it a shape, a pleasing shape, that it doesn't always seem to have in reality. So for all those reasons, I can't imagine doing anything else. But Rebus, no, I mean, he's not me. I mean, he sees the world very much in terms of black and white, good and evil. And I need characters like Siobhan Clarke, specifically, to try and persuade him there are shades of grey, which is my way of looking at the world. I'm much more like Siobhan Clarke and Malcolm Fox. Put them in a blender, blend them up, you get me. You don't get Rebus. I've never smoked in my life. His taste in music is mine, but his taste in music shuts off around about 1975, whereas mine has kept going. So there's a lot of stuff I listen to that he would hate. You know, we like a drink, but I don't drink nearly as much as he does. I'm not as much of a loner as he is. I enjoy other people's company. So he ain't me. you know, when people come to the Oxford Bar in Edinburgh, the fans who come from all over the world, and the owner says, oh, Ian's sitting in the back room if you want to say hello, they're always hugely disappointed that it's not Rebus sitting there. You know, because I'm not as complex as him. I'm not as damaged as him. I'm not as interesting as him. I'm not as dangerous as him. He's the guy they're looking for.
Ian Rankin's new novel is Rather Be the Devil. It is published by Little Brown. Ian Rankin, what a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much. I've been such a fan of your work, and it's a great thrill to have you on the program.
Thank you. It's been great.
Thank you. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.